Across the Pacifica network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 28, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Just released statistics say the US prison and jail population has increased for 2002. South Korea and the US celebrate 50 years since signing the armistice ending the Korean War. And anti-nuclear activists gather in Colorado in solidarity with three nuns who were sentenced last Friday for civil disobedience at a nuclear missile silo. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Andrew Stelzer with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Seven U.S. soldiers have been killed in the past 24 hours in Iraq. Some U.S. troops are concerned that the increased violence may be in retaliation for the reported killings of Saddam Hussein's sons, Uday and Qusay, last week. And five more Iraqis have been killed, as the United States claims they are stepping up the hunt for Saddam Hussein. In Saudi Arabia, police raided a farm in Riyadh, killing six people. Two police also died in the raid. The Saudi police were allegedly hunting down men with links to Al-Qaeda. The Saudi government has stated their commitment to aid the United States mission to eliminate what the U.S. has identified as terrorist groups. But not everyone in the U.S. government takes the Saudi pledge on face value. Democratic Senator Charles Schumer from New York says large amounts of blacked-out sections of the recently released September 11th report should be available to the public, and a Saudi man with links to two 9/11 hijackers should be extradited. James Cullum reports from Washington, D.C.
Senator Schumer, along with families of seven 9/11 victims, released a letter asking President Bush directly to strong-arm the Saudi royal family into submitting Omar al-Bayoumi for trial under the United States' judicial system. The letter also asked for the release of 28 blacked-out pages in the recently released Congressional 9/11 report implicating Saudi Arabia as a harborer of terrorists. 15 of the 19 September 11th attackers were Saudis, and many U.S. officials in Washington think that because of the administration's oil ties to the country, it has become sort of a safe haven for terrorist groups. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
In Manila, about 300 members of the Filipino Armed Forces temporarily took over a hotel and demanded that the Filipino president, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, step down. Free Speech Radio News spoke with Renato Reyes Jr., who works with Bayan, an alliance of progressive groups in the Philippines.
The basis for the rebellion were very legitimate grievances related to corruption inside the military and what they perceived to be the collusion of the administration of Gloria Macapagal Arroyo with the terrorist actions which have taken place over the past few months. One of the more glaring allegations which sparked the rebellion was that President Macapagal Arroyo was also planning to declare martial law in August, and she will justify this with the prospective terrorist actions after the known terrorist Fatou Roman Algosi escaped. So this is a very serious matter, and unfortunately, the government chose to deal with it through the use of force and through intimidation and repression. What we can say right now is that the rebellion is over, but the problems remain, and the problems will persist because the administration has done nothing to truly address the grievances of the military as well as the grievances of the rest of the Filipino people.
That was Renato Reyes speaking with us from Manila. Violence in Liberia continues. 16 people were killed in Monrovia on Sunday. West African officials are meeting in Ghana and plan to send peacekeeping troops into Liberia later this week. FSRN correspondent Ingrid Drake reports from Washington, D.C. on Liberians' efforts to demonstrate their political power to the U.S. government.
More than 300 Liberians and their supporters gathered in front of the White House for a candlelight vigil. A majority of the participants were calling for an immediate deployment of U.S. troops in Liberia. Others raised the question of U.S. intervention in undermining African self-determination. Suzette Gardner from the group Organized Community of United People.
If the African Union is empowered, if ECOWAS is empowered to really do the peacekeeping and exercise the diplomacy which is necessary to bring peace there, that would be a better solution. Right now, the United Nations and, of course, the United States put a lot of pressure on these groups, which limits what they can really do.
As the group sang, prayed, and spoke out against the recent bombing that killed dozens of civilians, U.S. Park Police broke up the vigil. Many in the group decided to march into the street and slow traffic. Police surrounded the group when they gathered in front of the Washington Post and threatened to arrest people if they failed to disperse. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake in Washington, D.C.
Negotiations on the Central American Free Trade Agreement opened today. Shannon Young reports from New Orleans.
Delegates from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica arrived in New Orleans this weekend to discuss a new trade agreement that would essentially extend NAFTA to those five Central American countries. As has become custom with trade agreements negotiated behind closed doors, citizen groups have gathered to protest. On Saturday, demonstrators from a variety of groups marched through the rain to voice their opposition to the secret negotiations. Among the protesters' concerns were the potential impacts that CAFTA could have on the Louisiana shrimping industry. Prices for local shrimp have fallen by more than half in the past couple of years. As the Louisiana market bottoms out, the state's shrimping fleet has been reduced by one-third, and many believe that this trend will only be accelerated with the passage of CAFTA. Since the draft of the negotiations has not been released to anyone but those involved in the talks, the potential effects for its implementation remains unclear. From New Orleans, this is Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
According to statistics released yesterday by the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, America's prison population grew to 2.1 million in 2002, a 2.6% increase from 2001, and the largest increase since 1999. This at a time when many studies show that crime is actually declining. These latest figures show that people incarcerated for drug offenses now make up over half the prison population, while about one in every 143 residents was in federal, state, or local custody at the end of 2002. Jason Zeidenberg of the D.C.-based Justice Policy Institute says the prison population and budget figures taken together should be setting off alarm bells in state capitals.
What we know from the best research is that there's really no relationship between adding more prisoners and drops in crime. And there's been a bunch of different studies done on this by a bunch of different university professors around the country. There's really no relationship to the two in terms of what's been happening policy-wise in this country, and our prison population is going up because the politicians are choosing to do that.
And in states that have seen a rise in prison construction over the last few years, like the state of California, which has one of the highest incarceration rates next to Texas, community advocates say more prison beds do not make communities safer. Rose Blass is with Critical Resistance in San Francisco.
You also see study after study which shows that prisons don't make communities safer, that states with more prisons and more people in prison experienced less of a drop in crime than states that had fewer prisons and fewer people in prison. So many studies over the last, really 5 years, have shown just a complete lack of correlation between public safety, a reduction in crime, and the prison population. What you see is a prison population and a prison growth being driven forth by huge economic interests, both from in the public and private sector.
And it's precisely the big business interests in the prison industry that some say guarantee there will always be a need for incarceration. One of the big correction corporations, Cornell Corrections, received a boost after September 11, and in a shareholders' meeting soon after the attacks, CEO Steve Logan told investors that their company profits were set to increase as 50% of their prison population would be undocumented immigrants.
There are over 900,000 undocumented individuals from Middle Eastern descent. Now, keep in mind, that's half of our entire prison population.
As Cornell Corrections CEO Steve Logan says that over 50% of their profits have come from INS-related detention, the Bureau of Justice report found that these immigration detentions account for over 20% of the rise in incarcerations, while black men from 20 to 39 account for about a third of all sentenced prison inmates under state or federal jurisdiction at the end of December. The report also said that more than 10% of the country's black male population between the ages of 25 to 29 were in prison, compared to 2.4% of Hispanic males and 1.2% of white males in the same age group. Rose Blass again.
There's no doubt, and this study confirms again, that, you know, racism is really at the core of the criminal justice system, and you know, anybody who tells you otherwise is just lying, because it's not a debatable issue. These statistics, along with, you know, statistics that again show again and again that, you know, for example, you know, African Americans represent about 14% of the prison population nationally and about 14% of drug users nationally, yet they're, you know, upwards of 75% of the people in prison for drug crimes. Those kinds of statistics, I think, indicate very clearly that racism pervades every aspect of the criminal justice system.
And while yesterday's statistics do not surprise some, scholar and activist Angela Davis told FSRN that the movement to abolish prisons is growing.
Scholars and activists are beginning to think about what it might mean to conduct a popular campaign encouraging people to try to imagine a world without prison. The need to consider possibilities of the future that do not allow the prison to be a major presence on the social and political landscape, that need has clearly grown.
As Cuba celebrated 5 decades since the Cuban Revolutionary Forces attack on the Moncada barracks on July 26, which launched the Cuban Revolution, another 50-year commemoration this weekend marked the signing of the armistice ending the Korean War. U.S. and South Korean military officials gathered with dignitaries, including President No Mu Yong and New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark, to pay tribute to the 5 million dead, injured or missing in the Korean War. Hundreds of Koreans and American war veterans were invited to Seoul by the South Korean War Veterans Association. Nok Win and Yung Ji Kang report from Seoul.
Veteran Charles Ridgway traveled from Baltimore, Maryland to attend the ceremony. It's his first time back in Seoul in 50 years.
It's a great feeling knowing that we helped, you know, we were part of it. They're not remembering. We have that same problem in the United States. You know, people don't... The younger generation just don't remember the Korean War.
Ridgway's comments seem to ring true on the streets of Seoul, where for the city's residents, the historical day was a non-event. One Seoul resident shared the sentiments of his fellow Koreans.
I don't know. I think most of Korean people don't know the day.
Min Kyung-woo is an activist with Tongil Yeonde, or the Korean Reunification and Solidarity Association. He says that most South Koreans don't see any symbolic meaning in the armistice agreement. That's because while the armistice may have resulted in a ceasefire, it never truly brought the peace to the Korean Peninsula.
The peace armistice is dead. Only the framework remains, and it serves two purposes. One is to justify the U.S. occupation of South Korea. The other thing is to justify the U.S. hostile policy toward North Korea. So, to achieve South Korean independence and get rid of the obstacles of reunification, we need to change the armistice to a peace treaty.
Under the terms of armistice agreement, North Korea and China and the United Nations was supposed to hold high-level peace talks within 3 months, but promised talks never happened. The discussions were to include withdrawal of all foreign troops from Korea. 50 years later, more than 30,000 American troops are still here. More and more South Koreans are growing disgruntled with the U.S. troops' presence in South Korea, especially following the deaths of 2 young schoolgirls who were crushed by a U.S. tank during a military operation. Lee Kim Han-suk, the head of Women Making Peace, says the event marked a turning point in South Korean and U.S. military relations.
This incident made us see what the relationship between U.S. and Korean government. We began to believe that there is unequal relationship between two governments. So it means that we are under the American government, you know, in terms of power relationship.
Last week, U.S. military handed back control of the DMZ to South Korean troops for the first time. U.S. troops aren't leaving Korea, though. they are being redeployed south of Seoul. Min Kyung-woo says reunification cannot occur unless the U.S. troops leave South Korea.
현재 한반도에 놓인 군사적 대결과
To lift the tensions, military conflict, and hostile relations between all Korean people and the U.S. on the Korean Peninsula, I believe it would be the precondition of reunification.
전제를 만든다 이렇게 판단하고 있습니다.
Yes, Lord, no word. Yes, children.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eun-ji Kang with Nak In and Aaron Glantz in Seoul.
Yes, love, no bush. Yes, children, no bush. Yes, human, no bush. Yes, peace, no bush.
Anti-nuclear activists spread out across the remote plains of northeast Colorado over the weekend, bringing songs, poems, picnic baskets, and a message of resistance to over 40 nuclear missile silos. The event was called Adopt a Silo Day. It was organized in solidarity with three nuns who were sentenced to federal prison Friday for civil disobedience at one of the missile sites. From KGNU in Boulder, Sam Fuqua reports.
We're raging grannies who won't button up till we win the day. Gonna rage and roar, gonna stop all war.
The raging grannies are harmonizing, and the prairie grass is swaying in the hot wind that blows all summer on the Great Plains.
We're raging grannies who won't button up till we win the day.
The group of Denver grandmothers usually sing in the city at rallies and community meetings. Today, their audience is five other activists, a reporter, and one Minuteman III nuclear missile sitting in an underground silo 100 yards behind them.
And this is my first time at a nuclear site, and it's a bit scary because it's so peaceful all around and you realize what awful things could emerge from the ground there.
61-year-old raging granny Nancy Taylor.
I have three and one on the way. I'm very concerned for them and the war or the world that they're inheriting. I'm glad I'm not in their shoes.
That world includes hundreds of nuclear missile silos across the U.S., 49 of them in northeast Colorado. Each one of those was adopted Saturday by different groups of people working for peace. The actions of three nuns brought them to the remote weapons sites. Last October, Catholic sisters Jackie Hudson, Carol Gilbert, and Ardith Platty cut through a fence at one of the Colorado missile silos. They hammered the silo's lid and drew crosses on it with their own blood. On Friday, a federal judge sentenced them to prison terms ranging from 2.5 to almost 3.5 years. Before she was sentenced and taken off to federal prison, Sister Carol Gilbert said she was glad her actions inspired the Adopt a Silo campaign.
And I'm celebrating the fact that citizens in this land are going to expose America's weapons of mass destruction, especially in the state of Colorado.
Adopt a Silo organizers decided beforehand that they would keep their protests within the law and stay outside the silo fences.
10:93 is his time.
The protests did not attract much attention from local residents. Many of them were at a kids' rodeo in the tiny town of New Raymer. The missiles have been here since the 60s, and Monty Youngland says he supports the nuclear weapons in his backyard.
Tickled to have the armed forces and the missile bases around here just for the fact that it is a free country and we have that backup system here for us. They can protest and they have their views and feelings too, but I'll say if they come up here and try to put their views and opinions onto us, they're going to have something else coming to them.
BS, BS, it all sounds like BS to me. BS, BS, it all sounds like BS to me.
Although some of the locals are comfortable with the nukes, 77-year-old Mag Seaman, with the Raging Grannies singing group, says many people are frightened by what lies beneath the quiet, rolling prairie of northeastern Colorado.
We have to let the people of Colorado, and the world, I guess, know that these things are on trigger alert. They can wipe any city out within a few seconds. It's highly dangerous, and it's scary.
With the push of a little red button, our weapons go up in the air.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sam Fuqua in Boulder.
Peace sides are way over there.
Coalfield residents in West Virginia and four surrounding states reacted to this month's release of a government report on the effects of mountaintop removal mining throughout the Appalachians. The new environmental impact study, like the Bush administration's new policies on logging on federal lands, recommends the easing of government restrictions and the streamlining of the application process for new mine projects. Evan Davis was in Charleston, West Virginia, and spoke to community members. He files this report.
Coalfield residents in the Virginias, Kentucky, and the Carolinas responded at a public hearing last week to a long-awaited Environmental Impact Study, or EIS, on the impact of mountaintop removal mining in the Appalachians.
This EIS statement is a sham, and it's a disgrace to even present it to the people of this state. You have poisoned and polluted and blasted and dusted the environment to death.
The report, released earlier this month, was the result of a joint study conducted by federal agencies such as the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the Department of Interior's Office of Surface Mining. And while it identifies what many residents agree are the destructive effects and dangers of mountaintop removal, a method of mining which involves blasting away the tops of mountains to expose thin coal seams, the report concludes that the practice still offers economic and environmental advantages, and that the permitting process for new claims should be significantly relaxed to encourage more, not less, mountaintop removal.
My name is Julia Bonds. I live in the Coal River Valley in southern West Virginia. I'm the sister, daughter, granddaughter, and great-granddaughter of coal miners. My home is in the heart of your study area. This draft EIS is a blueprint for continued assault upon the people of Appalachia, a declaration of war upon our children, their children, and God's creation. This EIS encourages the coal industry to continue to use Appalachia and her children as a national sacrifice zone.
Among the problems residents attribute to mountaintop removal is the increase in catastrophic flooding in the mountain valleys downstream from the mining sites. Surface soil and vegetation naturally absorb and retain water from rainfall, and when the soil, the plants, and the rock strata are removed, leaving a flat, non-porous surface, residents say that increased runoff is the result. However, Bill Rainey, the president of the West Virginia Coal Association, refutes that claim.
Well, the flooding's coming from the fact that you have too much rainfall in a short period of time in a small area. It's simply a popular trend and one that, some people in journalism, some people in what do you call groups, extremist groups, simply want someone to blame for the flooding, and there is no proof, and it just makes sense that water will lay on a tabletop much longer than it will on a wall. So it just simply makes sense that no, we're not contributing to that. That is not a valid point.
Industry advocates claim that by creating level areas where mountains once stood, opportunities for economic growth and development are being created.
My name is Kent Desrocher. I am president and general manager of Arts of West Virginia. The mountainous terrain in 14 counties has also slowed growth in the area. Industrial, commercial, and housing sites have been at a premium. The development of flat to gently rolling sites will assist in the growth and stability of the area. Through the development of post-mine land sites, including such diverse projects as industrial parks, golf courses, racetracks, recreational areas, housing, and public facilities, additional jobs are being provided for our neighbors and our children.
But most of the people at last Thursday's hearing who live in the affected areas are skeptical about the promised benefits of mine site reclamation.
My name is Patty Seabock, and I'm a lifelong resident of Boone County, West Virginia. If MTR mining provides so many jobs, then why are the coal mining counties the poorest of the state? We hear that there is no economic development because of the lack of potential development sites. Well, Big Coal River area has over 95,000 acres of flattened land. Is this not enough land for development? Where are the development plans for the land? What is the percentage of mountaintop removal sites that are developed from destroyed mountains?
A coalition of environmental groups throughout the Appalachians has pledged to keep up the fight to end the practice of mountaintop removal, and though the current climate of federal deregulation has increased the urgency of this issue, residents of these mountains say they are used to fighting uphill battles. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Evan Davis in Charleston, West Virginia.
A locked gate at the front of the Radio for Peace International studios in Costa Rica has kept staff members from leaving the station since an eviction notice was issued last Monday. Supporters call the eviction notice, issued by the United Nations project the University for Peace, politically motivated at best and an act of censorship at worst. The lock on the station's gate is only the latest in the months of hostile acts from the new university administration, but Radio for Peace staff say they refuse to stop broadcasting. From the studios of RFPI, Pauline Bartolone has the story.
The gate was locked. Both of the gates to the radio station were locked. And that was rather a shock because we had our cars inside and we had no way of getting out.
Emily Morales is operations coordinator at Radio for Peace International and has been working overtime to save the station since a University for Peace representative and two armed guards issued the station an eviction notice. Station supporters have been delivering food through the locked gates to those choosing to stay at the station 24/7, guarding it from forced eviction. General Manager James Latham now lives at the radio station. Standing behind its locked gates, he says the University for Peace's hostility indicates diverging values.
Well, we say peace and justice. They say peace and security.
The two projects were working harmoniously since 1985, when the radio station was first invited to build their studios on United Nations land. However, everything changed with the current administration led by Maurice Strong. Strong has served as a special advisor to the president of the World Bank and is a board member of the World Economic Forum. Since the university did not officially give reason for the eviction, James Latham and supporters believe that the actions are politically motivated.
There has not been a clear reason given to the radio station for its elimination, for it being shut down. So we have to consider the reasoning being censorship. They simply do not want RFPI to be broadcasting these programs of peace, disarmament, social justice, environmental protection.
Attempts to contact the University for Peace were unsuccessful. They told the Costa Rican press, however, that the radio station owes $14,000 for infrastructure installation costs, and that the frequencies used by the radio are not registered with the National Radio Control. However, the radio station says it is built on international territory, exempting it from Costa Rican law, is transmitting to an international audience via shortwave, and is registered with the High Frequency Coordination Committee. At a press conference on Saturday, board member and ex-president Rodrigo Carrasco said, "Violence is not a solution." RFPI lawyer Arcelio Hernandez and James Latham reminded the press the two peace organizations are compatible and must work together to promote peace.
We have much work to do in this world today with so many wars continuing on and conflicts, of people dying of hunger, homeless and poverty around the planet, that every peace organization and much more needs to be active on the world today.
If the station is forced to shut down, program director Naomi Fowler says the consequences will be devastating.
This is the biggest battle Radio for Peace International has ever faced in its 16-year history. It's symptomatic of what's happening globally to independent media, and we need to fight tooth and nail to save these things, because it will be very, very difficult to get these things back once they're lost. And the key to international political struggles today is the survival of international independent media.
It is not yet known what action the university will take against the radio station on the August 4th eviction deadline. Radio for Peace International says that it hopes to solve issues with the university through peaceful negotiations, and it plans to continue broadcasting indefinitely. From the studios of Radio for Peace in Costa Rica, I'm Pauline Bartolone for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.